Tigger asking you to please make good on your pledge. And if you haven't yet made a pledge to WBAI, now is the time. Just make out your tax-deductible check to Pacifica WBAI. Send it to WBAI, Post Office Box 12345. Hey, isn't that a handy number? 12345 Church Street Station, New York, 10249. That's a little harder to remember. 10249. Church Street Station, New York, 10249. Support independent, listener-supported, non-commercial community radio in New York. People's radio for us and our future. This is Pete Seeger still. Thanks.
Yes, yes, y'all. To the beat, y'all. Hey, you don't stop.
Yo, freeze, scumbag. Now drop that squeegee and put your hands against the wall.
Come on,
spread them.
Hey, I wasn't doing nothing, man. I was just holding it for a friend.
Yeah, that's what they all say. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can be held against you.
Oh, man, 6 hours out here. $2 to show for it. Now a night in jail. There's got to be a better way.
There is a better way. Just listen to our mayor, Rudolph Giuliano.
There are plenty of jobs available. A person who's a squeegee operator could work in a restaurant.
That's right, Rudy. And here at the Acme Technical School of Culinary Sanitation, you can learn all the skills you need to start an exciting new career as a restaurant dishwasher. In just 3 short months of daytime classes or 6 months of night school, you'll learn the techniques that will put you in control of your future. Skills like scraping, pre-rinsing, silverware maintenance, and dish stacking, all in our modern, state-of-the-art, simulated restaurant kitchen. Our highly qualified teachers are seasoned professionals. They'll teach you how to use the skills of the trade, and at the end of your training, the complete toolkit will be yours to keep. Upon graduation, you'll be given...
All right. We just found out this goes for another 5 minutes. We don't have the time for it, but it is very, very interesting nonetheless. It's time now for Off the Hook here on WBAI. Good evening to everybody. This is Emmanuel Goldstein. The program is Off the Hook, where we talk about the latest in telecommunications and computer happenings, high tech, and the future as far as freedom of speech, First Amendment, and all that kind of thing. We have some interesting stories today. We'll be taking some phone calls a little later on, and just updating you on what's been happening since we were here last. And a couple of you may have actually been listening to various radio stations, reading newspapers. You might have seen something kind of funny, well, funny from a consumer point of view, involving something that NYNEX did last week. Happened right about this time, actually. They sent out a mailing to encourage people to use their calling cards. It was called the Only in New York Sweepstakes, and it was intended by NYNEX to encourage calling card use, generating additional revenue for the company, especially with those nifty little surcharges they stick on every single call you make. Every local call made with a calling card from April 4th to May 31st automatically qualifies a cardholder for one entry in the sweepstakes, which offers $150,000 in prizes from a $50,000 New York municipal bond to movie tickets. And According to the New York Times, the mailing was sent first class, but it came as a folded card, glued at two corners rather than in a more secure envelope. And if you happen to open up that card, well, you get the person's PIN number for their calling card. Yeah, they printed everybody's PINs on these throwaway cards. And, of course, it's a trivial matter to get somebody's phone number when you already have the name and address printed there. So if you really wanted to, you could perhaps jump into a dumpster and find hundreds of these things, get hundreds of PIN codes, hundreds of names and addresses, and simply look up the names and addresses and you have a bona fide calling card. This promotion was the brainchild of executives at 9X's Product Management Group, who oversee the marketing of calling cards. It was developed with Wilkin Promotion and Advertising, in case any of you are interested in similar such promotions. They're a direct mail marketing company in Wayzata, Minnesota. Only out of a place called Wayzata could you get something like this. Wayzata, yeah. According to 9X, Steve Marcus, a spokesman, we were concerned about the security of the pins, and we thought we took prudent steps. He said the mailing materials have been reviewed by postal authorities. In hindsight, he added, maybe we should have done it differently. We have to do it again, we'd give it more thought. Yeah. They tell us to keep our calling cards safe, and then they go and they plaster them out on mailings, mass mailings to everybody. What are these people thinking? So, right now, about, I'd say several hundred pins have been changed because people have called up to complain. You know, you don't know who was supposed to get this this little card and who wasn't. I didn't get one. Maybe mine was stolen. Maybe everybody's was stolen. So, really, the only thing you can do is call up 9X and complain and have your pin changed. What else are you going to do? Okay, but the big story this week has got nothing to do with calling cards or even 9X. It's got to do with the Internet. It has to do with copyright infringement, has to do with the First Amendment, has to do with the whole future and how it's going to affect all of us. And you know, the more you look at it, the more grim it appears sometimes. This is something that made the front page of virtually every newspaper around here. Made the front page of the Times, made the front page of even Newsday, I think. And it's kind of a scary story when you read between the lines, when you see where things are going. First, we'll take a look at what the Times had to say, and then we'll look at what some people close to the case are saying. And then, of course, we'll listen to what you have to say. A federal grand jury has accused a student at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, of using university computers to distribute more than $1 million worth of pirated software over the Internet. In announcing an indictment last Thursday, United States Attorney in Boston, Donald K. Stern, called it the nation's largest single case of software piracy to date. The indictment says that David LaMaccia, a 20-year-old electrical engineering and computer science student from Rockville, Maryland, in effect transformed two MIT computers into electronic bulletin boards on which Internet users could place copies of commercial programs, allowing other users to receive illegal copies. The indictment says Mr. LaMaccia was one of the system operators, or sysops, of the bulletin boards, which were called Cynosure 1 and Cynosure 2. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And established in November 1993. They were shut down on January 5th of this year. The indictment also cited messages in which users posted requests for specific programs which cost as much as $300 or more each. My, my. The Software Publishers Association, which is a terrorist a trade association that represents more than 1,000 personal computer software makers, estimates, and this is only an estimate, mind you, that software piracy within American businesses cost software makers $1.57 billion last year. Oh, that's a hefty loss, isn't it? $1.57 billion. We'll talk about that in just a little while. In response to complaints from software makers that existing copyright laws were too lax in an era when computers can make exact copies of books, programs, and musical compositions in seconds, Congress, in their infinite wisdom back in 1992, decided to make it a felony to copy 10 programs, or to distribute or copy programs worth $2,500 or more. That's according to the people that sell the programs, how much they're worth. So if you do that 10 times, copy a program without having permission to do that, do it 10 times, it's a felony. Not a misdemeanor, mind you. No, this is tough talk. A felony. Oh, yeah. So, okay, we have that to look at. Now, we have somebody that's being charged with something pretty serious. And we also have the whole basic way of looking at this particular issue. Is it flawed or is it the right way to look at it? That's what we're going to explore in the time we have today. Now, we're going to look at a publication called Computer Underground Digest, which comes out electronically. The latest issue has a piece from the legal people, the people that are representing David LaMaccia. Silverglade and Good is the legal firm. And this is a posting that they submitted that kind of presents their point of view as far as this kind of thing goes. And we'll look at this and then we'll analyze it a little bit. The charge in the indictment. The indictment charges that David LaMaccia, by operating a computer bulletin board system, or BBS to many of you, at MIT during a period of some 6 weeks, thereby permitted and facilitated the illegal copying and distribution of copyrighted software by other unknown persons, presumably the many computer users who logged onto the BBS. It is further alleged that LaMaccia knew that others were using his system for such a purpose, although it is not alleged that the BBS was not used for other lawful communication purposes as well. In other words, the BBS was a perfectly legitimate BBS. Nobody's denying that. Okay. There is no allegation that LaMaccia himself uploaded, downloaded, sold, profited from, used, or actually transmitted any such software. The government does not allege that LaMaccia violated the federal copyright or computer fraud statutes. Rather, the prosecution has charged him with engaging in a criminal conspiracy to violate the federal wire fraud statute, which was enacted in 1952, to prevent the use of the telephone wires in interstate fraud schemes. Simple enough. This is not a case about whether software piracy is illegal under federal law. Both sides in the case are proceeding and will proceed on the assumption that it is not lawful to make and distribute copies of copyrighted computer software without paying a licensing or royalty fee to the copyright owner. This, according to the legal people, this is not about software piracy. We'll get back to that. David LaMaccia is not alleged in the indictment to have uploaded or downloaded to anyone or even used personally any copyrighted software in the computer bulletin board system. He's not alleged to have sold any copyrighted software, nor profited one penny from the copying or distribution of such software. And it is not alleged that the computer BBS was used exclusively to transfer copyrighted software. The indictment alleges that part of the conspiracy was to transmit files and messages on the system, part was to create a library of software, and that part of the scheme was to allow some users to unlawfully download copyrighted software. This case raises the following significant issues in the overall larger question of whether and how the principles underlying freedom of speech and of the press, the First Amendment, will be applied to the world of computer communications. For instance, under current criminal statutes, may a systems operator of a computer BBS be held criminally responsible for what users of the system do while logged onto the network, including the exchange of copyrighted software or the publication of other copyrighted materials? If current criminal statutes, including the wire fraud statute that LaMaccia is alleged to have conspired to violate, are interpreted to reach the SysOp, who does not himself upload, download, copy, use, or sell copyrighted software, Do those statutes, as so interpreted, violate the First Amendment? And are they therefore unconstitutional? Now, this is interesting because if we look at this with regards to other parts of society, we'll see something pretty interesting. Here are a few examples. It is well known that certain classified advertisements for dating services found commonly in some newspapers are really covers for high-class prostitution rings. Yeah, yet only the people who actually run the prostitution services are prosecuted for those violations of law. Editors and publishers of the newspapers are not prosecuted on some legal theory that their classified sections, and therefore they themselves, somehow aided or conspired with the prostitution rings in the criminal prostitution enterprise, even if the editors and publishers were well aware of the fact that their newspapers were being misused for an illegal purpose.
The problem isn't being poor. The answer is...
It is well known that gambling numbers syndicates utilize newspaper reports of scores of the outcomes of certain athletic events as the basis for illegal sports betting operations. Only the bookies are criminally prosecuted for such gambling activity. The newspapers, their editors, publishers, and reporters included, are never criminally prosecuted for the illegal activities of those who thus use the published sports reports. In nearly every lending library in the country, there are one or more photocopying machines sitting in the midst of large numbers of books, many of which are copyrighted. Librarians surely understand that a certain number of people who make photocopies on those machines are copying copyrighted material, perhaps in violation of the copyright laws. There does not appear to be a criminal prosecution of any such librarians for aiding or facilitating breaches of the copyright laws. Finally, the owner or manager of a bookstore may not be criminally prosecuted for the distribution of obscene material if, in a bookstore carrying a wide variety of printed materials, a certain quantity of those materials contain obscene portions. It doesn't even matter whether the bookstore owner or manager suspects that some of the material in the store may contain obscene matter. It is not his or her legal responsibility to monitor and censor such materials. That, according to the United States Supreme Court. All right, so this is where I wind up disagreeing with the representatives here, the legal people that are representing Dave LaMaccia, because I think this is very much about software piracy. Maybe not so much as Dave LaMaccia is concerned, but certainly it's because of our crazy way of looking at copying software. It's because of that this kind of thing can be gotten away with, where somebody can actually be charged with some sort of a crime for running a bulletin board where people might be able to copy software. Now, let's look at the facts. Software is copyable. It's meant to be copied. You're given a disk, and there's no way to prevent somebody from copying that disk onto another disk. Now, because some company, and because the SBA decides to back this up, says that their particular program is worth $10,000, well, that means that we're going to be charged with stealing $10,000 if we copy a program from one disk to another. It just doesn't hold up. It's a leap of logic, a very big leap of logic, maybe even two leaps of logic to reach that conclusion. It just doesn't make sense. People are going to be copying all kinds of things. And despite the reign of terror that the SBA is interested in imposing upon us, it's going to continue. People will copy programs from their places of business and bring them home to their computers and use them there. College students will copy programs from the sync site, wherever it is they happen to be using computers, to use on their personal computers. Now, instead of prosecuting people for doing this, instead of putting the fear of the Lord into them and making them feel like criminals and hence make them start acting like criminals, instead of that, maybe we should be happy that people are actually using software, educating themselves on computers, designing things. You know, we think reading books is a good thing. We encourage people to read books if they have no money, but if somebody wants to use WordPerfect, well, they got to cough up $300 before they can even hit start. It's just not right, because the technological age will go nowhere if we create a whole society of has and have-nots. And unfortunately, I think the issue here is really about greed. It's the same kind of greed that you see with record companies. Record companies that boycott stores that sell used CDs. Yeah, used CDs. They don't want people to buy CDs again. They've already sold them. They've already sold them once, and they want to make it so people don't ever buy them again, only buy them new. But you can't resell it. Now imagine if General Motors felt that way. You know, they sold you a car, and they wouldn't let you sell it again. They wanted to sell the person who would buy from you a brand new car at much more money. You know, it wouldn't make sense, but these record company people think they can make a maximum amount of money by not encouraging people to buy used CDs. The same kind of mentality, except worse, with software companies, because they seem to think that everybody should pay list price, which is some outrageous number. I mean, how many college students do we know that can afford to pay $300 for a word processor? I don't think I've ever met one. It's not something we're going to see very soon. So, of course, college students are going to copy programs so that they can use them. The alternative, and I've heard people from the SPA say this, the alternative is to simply not have access. You can't afford it? Okay, you just don't buy it then. You're not allowed to use it. I mean, come on, this is the 1990s. Everybody's got a computer, everybody's playing with something, everybody is trying to figure things out. It's all a big adventure, we're all playing. You can't expect people to just turn and walk away and not participate because they can't afford it. And by the same token, you can't expect people to believe that copying a file is the same thing as stealing a file. Stealing means taking an object that does not belong to you and removing it from where it belongs and keeping it for yourself. That's the interpretation I've been brought up on as far as what stealing means. Now, this half-cocked notion of any time you copy a file, you're stealing the full value of the file, and you have to believe whatever it is they come up with. It just it doesn't wash. You know, if the word processing programs and all the other programs were available for an affordable price, people would buy those. And the case in point, game software. Now, games tend to be a lot cheaper than various applications. A lot of people wind up buying games, you know, because it costs $20, it costs $30. You get the documentation, you get the hint book, you get whatever else you need. It's worth it. Just like if you read a book in a library and you really, really like it a lot, you'll go out and you'll buy your own. You'll have your own copy. If you listen to a cassette of a Nirvana CD because it happens to be in the news recently, and you decide, hey, I really like that, you know, and I want to have my own copy, and I want to have the pictures and the lyrics, even though they never printed the lyrics, all that kind of thing. I want to have that all. You'll go out and you'll buy your own. It might be a used one, but you'll still go out and you'll buy it, and you'll be supporting the people that either put out the record or wrote the software in whatever way. But when you make it so that it's impossible for people to buy things, when you make it so it's so incredibly expensive, and also where you don't really get anything from buying it that you wouldn't get from copying it, well, you can't really be surprised. Now, for instance, if you want to use a piece of software, you have to know that it's what you want. Now, how do you know that a particular piece of software is what you want unless you try it out? If you buy software from a computer store, many times there's a little disclaimer on there claiming that they are not responsible if the software doesn't work. If it doesn't work on your machine, if it doesn't do what you want it to do, they're not responsible. You got the software, that's it. They wash their hands. You spend several $100 on something, and it's not what you want. You're out of luck. Now, with that kind of attitude, how can anybody be surprised when people copy software and use it for their own testing purposes? Well, that's my opinion on all this. And I think it very much ties into the LaMachia case, because That's what this is about. This is about software piracy, quote unquote, and just who the pirates really are, who it is that's really gouging the market for all it's worth. I think we have to rewrite some assumptions here. It's just, it just doesn't seem logical. And I'd like to know if there's people out there that agree or disagree. Our number is 279-3400, area code 212. It just seems to me that we're criminalizing a lot of actions that really should not be criminalized, and creating a very scary society in the process. Because what are people going to do when they have to worry about the SPA or the federal authorities kicking in their door and demanding all kinds of paperwork, proof that they bought all the programs that are on their computer system? Not a very trustworthy society, is it? I'd also like to know how many software houses have gone out of business because of piracy. I don't really know if any have, and I think when you charge huge amounts of money, you tend to break even if only a couple of people pay full price. All right, again, our phone number is 212-279-3400. If you agree or violently disagree, please give us a call. Good evening, you're on.
Hi, I'd like to tell you my opinion on that, but I first want to tell you one important.
But first you're going to say something that's completely off the subject, right? Right? That's what you always do? No, go ahead. I just wanted to make sure. I just wanted to...
Well, yeah, but...
Okay, fine. Go right ahead. No, I just wanted to make sure that's what you were going to do.
Okay. I'm going to say something on the subject, but I just want to say this one thing first.
Okay.
I've noticed that there's a company called RCI Long Distance, which is in Rochester, New York, RCI, which their carrier access code is 10211. I noticed that in order to place a call, you dial that for zero, the area code number, and when I've noticed that they wanted to take a survey on their operator services, I think that that was a trap because I feel that they were recording my voice and that they're going to call all the numbers that I called and play my voice to them and say, do you recognize this person's voice? And that's how they'll catch
well,
fraud.
Why would they want to be trapping you?
Because I was going to a third number.
You're going to a third number?
Yeah. And well, that's probably
Who was paying for the calls you were making?
All right. Now, let me just get this straight. I was placing a third number call. Now, they didn't call for acceptance.
Uh-huh.
So I was doing this on a payphone, and they were not calling for acceptance. 10211, oh, the area code number. They didn't call for acceptance, but one day they said, we're taking a survey. So they asked me questions like, how fast do you think the operators go? And, like, rate them 1 to 10 and all. Were they recording my voice? And if so, can they send my voice?
I don't see why they'd have to do that when you call so regularly here. They could just listen to the radio and record your voice that way.
In Rochester, New York?
Well, I mean, you've admitted to virtually everything from chemical banks to destroying payphones and now RCI. So I don't think anybody has to look very far, do they?
Well, I don't know if they get the station in Rochester, New York. But
well, maybe they have friends in New York that can tape it for them and send it up to them. But I think basically you're pretty much giving them everything they need anyway.
My voice on that survey. Do they do that? Would they do take a tactic like that?
Well, sure. Why not?
You mean they play? If they called you up and said, "Hey, we'd like to play you a tape of somebody's voice. Can you tell us whether you recognize this person?"
I'm not saying you are, but if you were doing something to hurt this company, then more power to them for trying to trick you into revealing who you are. Absolutely.
But just by my voice. Not by my name. They don't have my name. They don't have my
number. Sprint has a program right now of voice-activated phone cards, and it works pretty well as far as differentiating one voice from another. The technology is there. They can do it.
Well,
I sense from that silence that you're thinking of moving to another city now.
You understand what I'm trying to say?
I think I do, but I'm not sure.
But what I'm trying to say is that can they take a person's voice, tape record someone's voice, send it to their security department, let's say, and then if there was fraudulent calls made, can they, let's say, take the numbers that were called fraudulently and call those numbers and say, can you recognize this person's voice that called?
They're not violating any law by doing that. You're calling them. They're recording your voice. They're not doing anything sneaky. They're calling the person, asking them a question. Yeah, they can do all that. Will they do all that? I don't know. But you're in an excellent position to find out. And when you do, let us know. Let's go to another call. Good evening.
WBII?
Yes. You're on the air.
Okay. Yeah. I agree with your position, Emmanuel, on software piracy and all that.
Uh-huh.
But here's the thing. In all fairness to the software companies, what about companies like Apogee, who at least release, say, a game, and say if you want to get the full version, pay $30 or whatever like that.
Right, that's good, because then you have a way of playing it, of seeing if it works in your system, seeing what the colors look like and how the controls work. And if you really like it, yeah, you'll pay the $30 to get the documentation and to get a better version, sure.
Yeah, and what about the Amiga owners? I mean, they got to call 3,000 miles away to get any software.
Uh-huh.
Because far be it from Commodore to support anyone.
Yeah, I've heard nasty things about Commodore support. Amiga people are an excellent example. They generally take care of themselves as far as supplying software. And they've formed some kind of a community where they basically just trade all kinds of things. But they all tweak the programs. They improve upon them. They release their own versions. And that's really what computers are all about. It's being creative as you go. And, you know, I think the people that put out the software are doing just fine. I mean, maybe I'm horribly wrong on this, but I don't think software companies are going out of business because of what nasty pirates and hackers are doing. I think actually what they're doing is being enhanced by that.
Yeah, true, especially in the Amiga community. But one other company who had that problem, too, was Atari.
Mm-hmm.
And those Atari people are, you know, all out of luck.
Well, I think the Atari just was a lousy machine, wasn't it?
Really, I mean, it wasn't a bad machine if you ever played with the Atari STs.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm thinking of the Atari 2600 and all that.
I'm thinking.
Yeah.
But anyway, are you going to be at the Trenton show?
When is that?
16th and 17th this Saturday.
Probably not. Doesn't look good. But why don't you tell the folks about it so that anybody listening can go?
Yeah, this is they're going to have the Trenton Computer Show April 16th and 17th at Mercer County College.
Right.
I mean, they just have some very good seminars, and a lot of Amiga people under the scenes are going
to
be there.
A lot of good things to buy, too.
Exactly.
I wish I could go, but this has been a crazy couple of weeks for me. I'm going to try to make it next year, though.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, we usually do some sort of a hacker debate kind of a thing. We just didn't have the
time.
Oh,
yeah, there is a lot of that going around. Computer crime and the First Amendment at 3:30 on Saturday.
Do you know who's on that?
Unfortunately, no. That's why I wanted to see. Somebody said you may have been on that.
Well, no, they wanted me to, but it's just a question of logistics.
Mm-hmm.
There's just too many things going on.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks, Emmanuel. You keep up the good work out there, okay?
Okay, thanks for calling.
Say hello to Mark.
I will.
Bye-bye.
212-279-3400. Good evening. You're on.
Yes, Emmanuel, I wanted to ask you something a little off the topic. I got a Western Union in the mail today from 9X.
A telegram?
Well, it was first-class mail. It wasn't specifically a telegram.
Okay.
I'll just read off the top to you. Dear 9X customer, recently we sent you a sweepstakes mailing as a reminder of the value of your 9X calling card. Also included, your personal identification number, PIN. Some customers, however, have expressed concern over the security of this mailing. Please be assured that the customer privacy is a major priority to us, and we have acted with only the best of our intentions. And it goes on to an 800 number you can call to report any problems with that or unauthorized calls on your card.
Uh-huh.
That's
great. So they had to send a telegram or whatever that Western Union thing
was. Actually a telegram, per se.
Is it Western Union or is it another kind of
thing? It says Western Union. It didn't actually, it came through U.S. mail, though.
Okay. I guess it's just to get your attention or something.
Yeah, I don't know what the Western Union has to do with it, but
do they have your phone number on this?
No, just my name and address.
And not your PIN?
Not my PIN on this one. This is a apology.
Yeah, see, they can learn. They can learn. So they sent you out another mailing that doesn't have your PIN on it.
Well, the thing is that I never saw this first one. I probably thought it was junk mail and just threw it in the garbage.
Or maybe you didn't see it at all. Maybe a mailman got it.
Well, yeah, maybe. I don't remember getting it, but anything like that, sweepstakes or whatever, I just throw in the garbage.
If we see a massive calling card fraud scheme hatched in the post office, I think we're going to know how it got there. You know? That's what I would do if I were you, since you know you were supposed to get one of these things, and since it got into the trash one way or the other, I just have it changed. I mean, do you use a calling card ever?
Well, the funny thing is that I don't even know what my PIN is. I don't use the calling card. It's too expensive.
Yeah, it is. You're right about that.
And to the best of my knowledge, I don't even think I have one.
Well, you probably do, or they gave you one or something, but... if you don't use it, you can't be held liable. Just watch your bill to make sure that no calling card calls come up. If you know, some the advantage to not changing it is you can see just where the weak point was and who's using it. But if you worry about that kind of thing, you should change it.
Great. One quick thing.
Yeah.
I was wondering when your next conjugal visit with fiber optic is.
Well, I think maybe you've been misinformed as to the nature of the visits, but it'll be fairly soon, I think. Hopefully. Within the next 2 weeks, although, as I've been saying, it's been a crazy couple of weeks. Let's go back to the phones. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I don't think you mentioned that some companies will give discounts to students, some software companies. And
I've heard about that, but I haven't seen specifics. Do you know the nature of the discount?
Well, I think Borland will give discounts to students who want to buy, like, Turbo Pascal or Turbo C.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't really kept up with it because I'm not a student, but... I'm sure there are plenty of other companies, and even if they don't publicize it widely, I'm sure if you call them up and ask them and say, I'm a student, how can I get a discount, they'll accommodate you.
Again, though, the only way to know, I mean, for a student, $20 is still a lot of money. You still have to know it's what you want, you know, so there has to be a period of testing somewhere.
Well, you know, most students have friends that have software already, and, you know, they can try it out, and ideally they would then purchase it if they... if they used it, but of course everyone knows that most people won't do that, students or not.
Right. Well, they would obviously copy it from their friends and use it that way. The incentive to buying their own copy would be to get something that you really can't reproduce, like a nice book or something like that, or just customer support where you can call any time to ask a question.
Well, exactly.
Like
I think customer support is what the company ends up paying for, because there's many other third parties or what have you that will write books that are in some cases even better than the manual, and you know, why spend $300 on a piece of software if you can pirate it for free and get a third party book for $20?
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's a flaw in thinking in the basic marketing of it.
Well, I also think that you're a little bit harsh on the software companies, because what costs them the most, I would guess, would be the tech support, the toll-free tech support. And even if it's not toll-free, they have to have people staffing those lines and pay them. And on top of that, they've got to pay for the printing and distribution of the manuals, which I understand is the most expensive part of the whole operation.
But more expensive than actually putting out the software.
Oh, yeah, the software, you just distribute, you just get the disc copy, which is like, you know, 25 cents a shot or something, but the manuals, actually printing them up, and if you looked at some of the manuals, they're, you know, as thick as a couple of phone books, and that's where the costs are, I think it's...
Well, you see, that's where they can charge more money then, because...
They have to charge more money. I mean, they can't charge you $30 for a piece of software if it costs them $30 right there just to print the manuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I'm saying, you can't charge $30 for a piece of software if it's just copying something onto a disk. People will pay for a big phone book filled with documentation that they can't get except if they photocopy 1,000 pages themselves. So that's obviously where they can charge a little more, and people will probably pay for it.
Right.
Not for the program itself, you see, because people, all right, there'll be all these people out there with programs without
the program
the documentation.
Itself, because there's the research and development cost of getting the program to the point where it is, and the 2 and 3 years of getting it to the point where it's bug-free enough.
Right, but in the end, I mean, you don't pay for all the costs of recording an album and for, you know, paying people's yearly salaries and sound engineers and things like that when you buy a record. You pay for the CD, you know?
Well, a CD's a little bit different. You know,
but look at the way it works. You pay the same amount virtually, whether it's Pink Floyd or you know, a band that's just out of a garage somewhere. You're paying for the product. You're not paying for all the time they spent on it. You see what I'm saying?
Well, I think the artist is being subsidized by the record companies to some extent.
Right. I think, you know, a similar type of thinking in that regard would be helpful, where, you know, you buy a disc and you can expect to pay this amount of money for the disc. You know, and if the program there is what you're looking for, all the better.
Yeah, well, that only works if people don't start copying.
Uh-huh. It works if people get something besides the disc when they buy it. You know, something that makes it worthwhile to have the original and not just a copy.
Yeah, well, the part of the problem is that each publisher has to have the they have to have the resources to print the manuals, and, you know, it's like a duplicated effort if every company is doing that themselves.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, it's a problem, I admit. It's definitely something that needs to be addressed. I just don't think the way they're addressing it now, having these strong-arm tactics with the SPA, I don't think that's going to get anywhere. It's just going to hurt a lot of people.
Yeah, I suppose.
Anything else?
Well, no. I'm just speaking from the side of a programmer who,
uh-huh.
I don't really have to make a living by selling my programs door to door, so to speak. But
right.
I've read a bit about what it costs to do this kind of stuff. And
well, you can still have things like corporate prices, corporate licenses, things like that. And a lot of companies out there will just pay it without any second thought because they can afford to.
Yeah.
So I don't think programmers or software companies are really going to be in danger because of this kind of activity.
Well, I'll tell you right now, if I were to want to write a program and sell it to the masses, there's no way I could, even if it was a great program, because I'd have to be a marketer first and foremost.
Right. Yeah. As an individual, it would be very difficult to do that. But once you have the support of a company and they're doing the marketing for you, I don't think you'd be in danger yourself.
No, but then I have the cost of the entire company, and that's why I have to start charging $100 for my software.
Uh huh. Well, you think you'd be able to charge less if you went through a company?
No. I mean, I don't know. To make a living, I might have to.
It's like writing a book or something. You know, you get somebody to distribute it for you. You don't do all that work yourself. You're the programmer. You're somebody who just should be programming.
Right.
Not worrying about the business aspects of it. You hire somebody else to do that.
Yeah, ideally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's it.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Sure.
Good evening. You're on.
Hello, I got one of those letters that looked more or less like a telegram also.
Really? A lot of them going around?
Yeah, and the carrier route pre-sort, so obviously they've mailed out quite a few. I called up the operator to find out what the surcharge would be on that calling card. The operator told me 50 cents, and I said, this advertisement says local. How local is local? She didn't know, so I called up the business office,
uh-huh.
and they told me the surcharge was 40 cents. I said, wait a minute, the operator told me it was 50. I said, well, I have to check into that. And I said, oh, and how local is local? I said, just area code 212 and 718. I said, yeah, I think it is. And I said, how about 917? The guy says, well, I don't think so. I said, well, 917 is local, isn't it? Well, first of all, when I called up the business office, I said, I'm calling about that calling card of which I'm sure you've heard so much about. He said, oh, no problem. Just give me your number. We'll take care of that. I said, I don't have any complaints except for the fact that the promotion didn't give enough information regarding the charges. Anyhow, they kept me on hold so long to try and find out
mm-hmm.
917 is a local number or not. I just finally hung up.
Wow.
It's amazing that they do a mailing like this, and they don't put down with it. Costs are to use the card, and when you call up the operator, you get one rate. You call up the business office, you get another rate, and the business office doesn't even know if 917 is one of the local numbers that you can dial with that card.
Well, you see, when they send out those advertisements, they're not sending them out with people like you in mind. They're sending them out with people like they'll see the sweepstakes. They'll see a trip to the Caribbean or wherever the prize was.
It's for imbeciles.
Right, and their eyes will light up with dollar bills, and they'll just start making calls, thinking that they're going to win something by making calls. They don't want people to ask questions like what you're asking, because that just sort of makes it difficult for them to explain their way out of it.
It's like a New York State lottery. It's a tax on stupidity.
Absolutely. But in this particular case, you're spending, what, 40, 50 cents more per call for the right to use this thing? It's absurd.
A local call, just put a quarter in a payphone.
If that much. If you make it from your house, it's less than that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that might even be too much.
But if I could call 914, for example, or if I am in 191... They can tell me whether or not it's a local call and how much it costs.
Uh-huh.
But they don't know.
Yeah, they don't. They're not lying about that. They really don't know. They don't take the time to learn about this kind of thing. They're not encouraged to. You know, the company is there to make money. The company is there to just bring in endless revenue by tricking people into dialing *69 and 900 numbers and what have you. They don't want people asking too many questions.
When I've used a *69, I found out that in most cases they were legitimate wrong numbers, that people had dialed and hung up at the last moment,
uh-huh.
hung up after it rang a couple of times.
Yeah, it really creates kind of a hostile environment when you call somebody up and demand to know why they just called you.
Well, it certainly is a way of generating extra revenue.
Yeah, 75 cents, even if it doesn't work.
Yeah.
That's that software publishing house mentality there. All right, thanks for your call.
Yeah,
good luck. So we need people out there asking lots of questions, being persistent. I mean, they hate it when you do that, but that's why it's so effective. Good evening, you're on.
Manuel, good evening.
How are you?
Good. I hate to the previous callers kind of stole my thunder, but if you're being a bit hard on at least WordPerfect, you can get as a student a copy of the newest version of it. Excuse me, the newest version of it for under $100, which I think is pretty fair market value.
Well, I've used WordPerfect quite a bit, and I don't know. I wouldn't give you $20 for it, to be honest, but that's my opinion. I mean, if there are people out there that can afford it, fine, but you have to understand that a lot of people, you know, $100 is still a lot of money to buy a program, even if you don't know what it does or if it works. So people are going to copy it to evaluate it.
Yeah, but I mean, how do you propose? I mean, it's true there are some companies that, like, offer the ability to try a program out for I don't know, 10 days or something.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, what are you proposing? You're proposing this kind of utopian world where profit isn't important, and it's not very realistic.
Well, it's also not realistic to think that people aren't going to simply do something that's so easy to do. If we really want to keep people from copying things, then maybe we should have a CD-ROM that has to be present in the machine so that people can't run the program unless they have it. I mean, that will stop people from copying it. But right now, you have a system where the program is there, it's able to be copied, and we can't prosecute people because they type a few commands on their computer, on their own computer, and copy a program that's meant to be copied. And it is meant to be copied. That's why it's done that way.
It's true, but I think the point of the lawsuit in practicality is that the guy was basically announcing it. I mean, I've made dozens of copies of other software, and I'm sure a huge percentage of the population does that as well. But when you start advertising it, when you start institutionalizing it, I mean, someone has to start doing something about it. It just, I mean,
they're alleging that he was part of a conspiracy of some sort to distribute this kind of thing.
I disagree with you that you consider this just software piracy. I think that if you keep it as the analogy with the librarian or someone else who makes accessible the possibility of copying and leave it at that, then I think he should not be prosecuted. Now, on a lighter note, I think with this 9X PIN number thing, I think it would be pretty funny and kind of a updated version of that scene in Woody Allen's Radio Days if people started winning prizes based on fraudulent calls. In other words, supposedly according to this contest, the more calls you make, the more you have the possibility of winning.
Uh-huh.
What I would do is advise people not to change their PIN number until the contest is over, and then claim your prize.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Great show. Keep up the interesting work.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Yeah.
That's an interesting idea. I wonder if 9X executives will decide to use a sense of humor on this. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hey, Manuel. How are you doing?
Okay, how are you?
I just have one comment and just two questions.
Can you just speak up a little bit?
I'm just going to ask my questions and then I'll hang up and let you answer it off the
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, first of all, just a quick comment. For some reason, there are three numbers. There's like 1-800-MESSAGE, 1-800-NY-CALL-ID, and then 1-800-THE-TONE. And they all seem to have the same ending number. In other words, you call them all and you get the same office. The weird thing is, when I called the NY-CALL-ID office, I got a recording,
uh-huh,
7 o'clock, saying it was closed, and it was open till 8 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
Then I called 1-800-THE-TONE, which is the exact same office, and I got through.
How do you know it's the exact same office?
Because I got the exact same operator with two different numbers.
Okay. That's those 800 numbers are kind of weird because they ask you to ask for a particular operator. If you want touch tone service, you ask for operator 366 or something.
Yeah, they asked for my operator code, and I wasn't exactly sure.
Yeah, it sounds so official.
Yeah.
But they don't. Sometimes they don't even transfer you. They just answer the question there. It's basically just like a way of saying what it is you want quickly.
And the next thing is just questions. First of all, do disclaimers work? There are a bunch of disclaimers floating around out there, which, you know, are used on bulletin boards, and they say stuff like, I don't know. They say if you're a law enforcement agent, work for a software company, you must leave.
No, they don't work at all. I've seen court documents where they've been introduced into evidence. Bulletin board printouts have been introduced into evidence, and the the person, the arresting officer, has always answered no to that question, and the judge does not even blink. It's admitted. The disclaimer is there's absolutely no good whatsoever.
Why is that? I mean, why... They don't have to go by it?
Well, if they believe that you're breaking the law, they're not going to turn around and walk away because you say, if you're going to prosecute me for breaking the law, you have to leave now. Because basically, in their eyes, you have absolutely no right to tell them what to do. That's really what it boils down to.
And the second question I forgot, so I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Thanks for calling. 212-279-3400, off the hook. We're here for about another 12 minutes or so. Good evening. You're on.
Oh, hi.
How are you?
Emmanuel.
Yes.
I'm kind of upset with the way you're going on tonight with the piracy business.
Okay.
To begin with, the first caller talked about the Amiga and the Atari. The Atari world died primarily because of piracy. And the Amiga world, forgetting Commodore screwing everything up, is also killing the Amiga world because small base and developers such as myself don't want to write code for it. When as soon as you write something, it goes out on the boards, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of companies, and when I wrote code, we would have demos, you know, with the save or whatnot, disabled, so you could have a demo copy and try it out, all right?
Right.
And when I invest hundreds and hundreds of hours writing code, it hurts me to see my work come on a board afterwards, okay? Because I'm doing this for a living. I mean, I'm not philanthropic, you know?
Uh-huh.
So you seem to see this is okay.
Well, I'm not saying this is okay per se, especially with regards to your point of view here, but we have to understand that there's literally no way to stop it in the way it is presently, and to expect people to simply live by these rules that are set down by SPA people, I don't think it's realistic. I don't think you can tell people this is worth $1,000. If you copy this, you're stealing $1,000. I think that's crazy.
Well, it's worth whatever it would cost you to buy it, you know, across the open market. Now, if I put a list price of $1,000 and the retailer sells it for $200,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, then that is what the value is. Okay, if you were to turn around and copy it and say, well, I'm doing this because, as you said, companies gouge the people. You know, I mean, this is not a music CD where you may sell a million copies or 2 million copies where they have a gold record and platinum and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
You're talking about a limited base of users. Not everyone is going to need Quark Express, okay?
Yeah, but there's all kinds of...
You see, that's what also determines price is volume. You know, if I sold a million copies of the program...
Mm-hmm.
And the price comes down, okay? But if you sell 3 or 4 or 1,000, then the price is going to remain high.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, for example, WordPerfect. Like one guy brought up that you can get a $100 version of it, you know, for students. If you buy the original package and then keep up with the upgrades are $50, $25,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, so for you to say, well, this software is made to be copied, it's not. We have to put in keyword encryption. We have to put in, like on the old Commodore days, copy protection schemes that would bang the hell out of a drive, and people were pissed, and rightly so.
Mm-hmm.
But we're trying to protect our product. I mean, there are copyright laws which guarantee my intellectual property.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to point out is that those laws are completely, they have no effect because how are you going to enforce something like that? It's to bring back the analogy of music, though, let's look at a very small band that's just putting out their first record or even a cassette. And I know people that are in this situation. People copy it. People pass it around. You know, it doesn't result in more sales for the band, but at least their music is getting out. At least it will lead to something bigger for them at some point, maybe. But it's also people, if they want to support the band, they will buy the original record so that the band actually gets money. And I think we need the same kind of mentality in the software world, where if you believe in something, you want to support it, so you buy the original and you get the support and you get upgrades.
Granted, but
at an affordable price.
Turn around and have the attitude of, well, software companies are gouging. which is a very common theme.
Well, many times they are.
Well, but again, how you define gouging? I mean, you know, when you spend thousands of man hours, you know, writing code, debugging code, I mean, this is an investment. You know, I mean, you can't turn around and say, well, gee, I've spent, you know, 3,000 hours writing code, and you can have it for $50.
Yeah.
It just doesn't.
Yeah, but you see, if you sell your program to a number of people, I think that's a very fair price because you're certainly getting compensated by the number of people that buy the program.
Yeah, but when you have the attitude it's okay to copy it, then, you know, it's that extra step is like, well, I'll copy it, and I'll try it out now, and then I'll buy the copy down the road, okay, legitimate copy. It never happens.
Well, how would you expect people to know that your program is what they want?
Well, we give demo copies.
Uh-huh.
Have certain key functions disabled. For example, I'm working on a utility right now where you can do everything but save it.
Okay.
And, you know, it's not there. So, for the cost of a disk, which is like $3, you can try the program out. You like it, fine. Send in the order form. We'll send you a fully enabled copy. You don't like it, format the disk.
Uh-huh.
You know, give it to your friend, fling it out the window.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's it. Or else we go into a keyword encryption, which nobody likes. You know, but right. I'm trying to protect my property.
Right. The thing is, though, I mean, if your property is priced fairly, you're not going to have a problem. But if it's priced beyond the reach of people that want to use it.
You do for a living. I mean, do you write code? Do you design?
Okay, good example. I'm a publisher. I publish a magazine.
Right.
People copy our magazine all the time. I mean, it gets Xeroxed and passed around. It's not that big a deal because we're still selling the magazine. We're still able to support the magazine. If it became a big deal where more copies were out there than originals, then it would be a problem. But I don't see that in the software world. I don't see that in the publishing world.
But it is a problem.
It can be a problem. If it becomes out of control, it can be a problem. But you have to ask yourself, why would somebody prefer a copy over the original? You know, that surely there must be more to the original than just the program itself. And if not, then there should be, because that's what people will buy it for.
It's tech support. If you have a if you don't understand the program,
uh-huh,
there's a number that you can call.
Right.
Okay, that price gives you the right to pick my brains.
Okay.
Ask for my help.
Well, that's something then.
Okay. In addition to, once you become a registered user, well, then when I do find bugs, or else there is an upgrade,
mm-hmm,
I'm going to be notified of it. Okay?
Right.
There are advantages. And I mean, you also will keep me, you know, you'll give me the impetus to keep developing the programs. Okay,
so you've named three things, and I think those are three very important things. They have to mean enough to the end user for them to want to invest the money into it. And what I'm saying is right now with commercial software, with a lot of commercial software, it doesn't mean that much to them, so they don't want to invest that. We need to change that aspect of it and not simply charge people with stealing huge amounts of money if they copy a program.
But you see, you're putting the software publishers, it's like these big mega corporations where we can absorb these losses. And I tell you the truth, a lot of software publishers are small houses.
Mm-hmm.
You would be shocked at how few people there are that make up a quote-unquote publishing house.
Well, when you're represented by companies like SPA, you tend to get a negative image.
Well, again, where is my recourse? Okay.
Well, I think the recourse here, as I've said, is to look at the situation in a realistic way and to realize that there's something fundamentally wrong with simply expecting people to pay full price because that's what you want them to do and ignore the fact that they can get it for free and virtually untraceable. I think there's something fundamentally wrong with that logic.
Well, there are one or two valid points which a lot of users do bring up, is that sometimes what is basically a beta version of a program will go out.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that. And there, you've got a valid argument. But the bulk of the publishing houses work on a very slim margin, okay? I mean, I'm not Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, by no wild stretch of that, you know. So I don't have that type of funding. I don't have the material. I don't have the manpower, you know. So for every copy that gets put onto a bulletin board, you're hurting me.
Mm-hmm.
and that means that I'm going to be less inclined to support what I've already done, which hurts the users who have bought. Okay? So, I mean, that's basically the bottom. I mean, I'm trying...
Well, the thing is, you have to make that clear to the degree where people won't do that because it hurts you. They have to see the connection.
I'm not the only one that's saying this. Okay?
Right.
There are other software houses that say the same thing. Piracy hurts the end user. It's the guy who is willing to play by the rules, quote-unquote, and put down his money. All right? Anybody who puts down his money and buys the product deserves all the help that they need to get the program working.
Right. Well, now you're speaking on behalf of small software publishers. What about the larger ones?
Well, what about them? I mean...
Do you think they're completely innocent in this?
Yes and no. I mean, they work on... They're a different end of the business, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But again, they also work on small profit margins, and yeah, they have greater costs than I have, and they you know, I don't know. It's hard for me to like defend Microsoft. I mean, I don't want to be in that position, but I can understand that they also have salaries to pay and development time to fund. You know, beta. Printing. It somebody has to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, it's just there. I see a collision between two worlds here. I see the corporate world and I see individuals, and they can't be expected to pay in the same way. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Corporate world. I mean, corporate world is made up of individuals,
right?
Boring salaries who are raising families. You know, I mean, it's not that cold-blooded, which you seem to make it out.
Yeah, but a corporation can pay $1,000 for a piece of software, whereas very few individuals will ever be able to do that.
Well,
so you can't really expect the same rules to apply to both. There should be some sort of a medium. Maybe you should charge different prices for companies that use your products, and certainly more people will have access to it then, and lower prices for individuals so that more of them will have access and be less inclined to go out to a bulletin board to get it.
Well, I think people who are inclined to go out to a bulletin board will go regardless of what the price is. I was because I used to be an Amiga user and a developer, and I still get one of the English magazines, and I was reading that.
Well, the thing is, not to cut you off, Andy, but we are out of time.
But let me make one point.
Yeah.
They reissue games. Like, they'll start out at, like, $40, and then they'll reissue them down to, like, $10. And they're finding that even the games that are issued out at $10 are still being pirated.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's this class of people who are pirate.
Yeah, there probably is, but there are also the serious users that will want the original. And I don't think you're going to lose them because lots of other people are doing it a particular way. I don't think you're ever going to lose them completely. Thanks for the call, though.
Okay.
All right, good luck. And that's just about all the time we have tonight. This has been Off the Hook. It's been an interesting show, and... we're going to be talking about this for quite some time to come. This is something that I think has been brewing on a lot of people's minds for many a year now, and maybe this LaMachia case will make it finally come to the forefront. Even though it's not really a case about software piracy, it's more about conspiracy, but these issues are going to come up. Something that we need to address, something we need to solve if we want this whole computer thing to work out. This is Emmanuel Goldstein. I'll be back again next week with another exciting edition of Off the Hook. Stay tuned for the evening news, WBAI, New York. Good night.
Good evening. In the news tonight, more violence in the Middle East as an alleged suicide bomber blows himself up in northern Israel. Congress begins working on the updated version of the crime bill. And in New York, more protests over the mayor's budget cuts. And David Sears looks at the international implications of a major environmental court action against Texaco. With these and other stories, I'm Jose Santiago in New York with Verna Avery Brown in Washington. And this is the news for Wednesday, April 13, 1994. First to Washington for the Pacifica National News.
6 Israelis were killed and about 30 injured as a bomb exploded on an Israeli bus in the town of Hadera. Daoud Kutab reports from East Jerusalem.
The explosion took place on the eve of the 4-6 Independence Day of Israel. A spokesman for the Islamic Hamas movement in Jordan said that this is the second in 5 attacks that will take place against Israelis in revenge for the Hebron massacre. Palestinian leaders, including PLO chairman Yasser Arafat, quickly rejected and condemned this attack against civilians and called for the need to speed up the peace process as the best way to end the cycle of violence. Tuesday, a pregnant Palestinian woman was killed by a Jewish settler and the home of a prominent physician was blown up. Israeli politicians opposed to the peace process called for a suspension to this process. Opposition leader Benjamin Netanyahu of the Likud said that the attacks against Israeli civilians show that there is a terror process, not a peace process. The Israeli government, which had carried out extreme precautionary security steps, felt embarrassed by the attack, but insisted that the peace process will continue nevertheless. For Pacifica Network News, this is Daoud Kutab reporting from East Jerusalem.
In western Germany, 4 right-wing youth accused of the arson murders of 5 Turkish women and girls last year went on trial. 2 of the defendants maintained they had no role in the fire. Alexa Dvorsin reports from Cologne.
It's been nearly a year since the arson attack in the Dusseldorf suburb of Solingen hurled Germany's plague of neo-Nazi violence to a horrifying dimension. The 4 youths, aged 16 to 24, stand accused of the worst racial attack since German unification in 1990. Prosecutor Dirk Fernholz told the packed court that the defendants saw themselves as rightists, identified with slogans like Germany for the Germans, and killed the 5 Turks and threatened the lives of 14 others out of hatred for foreigners, particularly Turks. The prosecutor said the youths were drunk when they set fire to a house owned by a Turkish family who had lived in Solingen for 20 years. 24-year-old defendant Marcus Gartman, who has confessed to the arson attack, faces life imprisonment if convicted. 2 other youths, and possibly a third, are charged as juveniles and face a maximum of 10 years in prison if convicted. The trial is expected to last until October. For Pacifica Radio News, this is Alexa Dvorsin in Cologne.
Another legal challenge this week against a state for refusing to follow the federal Medicaid law. Jack Campbell has details from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
20-year-old Celia Courage of Tulsa filed a federal lawsuit to get Oklahoma to conform to Congress' Hyde Amendment and allow Medicaid-eligible abortions for rape and incest. Sherry Finnick of Tulsa's Reproductive Services says the state presently allows Medicaid abortions only when the woman's life is in danger.
It's just very difficult from a personal and a professional standpoint to have to explain to them that the state of Oklahoma is so callous and cruel that it will turn its back on these women and not allow them to receive the medical care that they need with that, and help them with that financial responsibility.
The lawsuit is being handled through the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy. Courage's pregnancy is the result of incest. For Pacifica Network News, this is Jack Campbell in Tulsa.
U.S. tobacco companies have revealed the 599 chemicals they add to cigarettes. The list had been on file with the federal government, but had been kept under wraps because the tobacco companies said they were trade secrets. Now tobacco companies say they are making public the list because critics, in the words of one company, have attempted to discredit the industry by using false information. This comes just one day before U.S. tobacco company executives are to testify on Capitol Hill about the safety of cigarettes. And those are the stories topping the news. The scientific community came under fire on Capitol Hill today over 13 years of fraudulent data produced for a major breast cancer study. The government says despite the fraud, the results of the study are still valid. But a House congressional subcommittee made it clear today that the credibility of the scientific community was at stake. Pacifica's Don Rush was there and files this report.
The story began back in the 1970s when the most often used technique for breast cancer was a mastectomy. A push was underway to find a less radical procedure and produced a technique known as a lumpectomy. In 1977, Dr. Roger Poussin began funneling patients into a study that combined a lumpectomy with a follow-up procedure of radiation and chemotherapy. It was not until 1990 that a researcher accidentally discovered that Poussin had actually falsified documents to get some of his patients into the program. A series of government agencies were brought in to investigate the situation over the next 4 years, including the National Institutes of Health and the National Cancer Institute. They concluded that despite the falsified documents, the lumpectomy procedure was still a valid treatment. 32-year-old Jill Siegel underwent the procedure 6 months ago, and she told the subcommittee this was still not very reassuring.
If my cancer returns, it is likely to come back in my liver, my lungs, or my bones. My doctors tell me that if this happens, my cancer cannot be cured and I will die. If this happens, my family and friends will never know if my cancer had spread prior to my operation and there really wasn't much that anybody could do, or whether the reoccurrence was due to the fact that I had a lumpectomy instead of a mastectomy.
And she told the subcommittee, knowing what she knows now, she would have opted for a mastectomy. This is not the only recent incident of its kind. There is a new treatment for women who are at a high risk for breast cancer. The drug is called tamoxifen and has been used to treat women who have undergone procedures for breast cancer. Specifically, it is designed to prevent cancer from developing in the second breast. But over the last few years, it has been found to raise the risk of cancer of the uterus. National Cancer Institute officials admit scientists were aware of the problem 2 years ago, and they are only now notifying women involved in the tests. The message from health officials was these things can be corrected, but advocacy groups say that's not enough. They want more input from women into the research process. Fran Visco, president of the National Breast Cancer Coalition.
I've been told not to overreact, not to question too much. No, we didn't perform fraud. We didn't neglect to uncover fraud for 13 years. We didn't delay reanalysis of data. We didn't keep information from the public. The scientific community did that, and we have every right and indeed a responsibility to call them to task for this.
So how did these scandals come about? The problems, say officials, lay with the prestige of the physicians involved. Dr. Bernard Fisher, who oversaw the lumpectomy study at the University of Pittsburgh, was a preeminent figure in his field. Government officials just recently ordered his dismissal as head of the center doing such studies. NCI Chief Samuel Broder.
We clearly understand the principle that we cannot allow a grantee's formidable reputation, history of prior accomplishments, or service in science to stand in the way of prompt corrective action and oversight. Prior achievements do not render individuals immune to what we must get from them. We cannot and will not ever defer or appear to defer to the timetable of a grantee of whatever preeminence in reporting fraud and fabrication to the public.
But Broder told the subcommittee that women should not be alarmed about the lumpectomy scandal. He said there were other studies that supported its continued use. But Colorado Representative Patricia Schroeder told her colleagues it was incidents like these that left women wondering about the scientific community.
Somebody felt, it wasn't that important. They could sit on this falsified data, not do anything with it. And by the way, it didn't matter anyway because they had some other data. Is it any wonder sometimes we women think that we're not getting a decent deal and that our health is not being treated with the same respect that other people are?
Don Rush, Pacifica Network News, Washington.
Members of the United Farm Workers Union, retracing the steps of the late Cesar Chavez in a cross-California pilgrimage, have reached the halfway mark. The president of the group says the spirit of Cesar is with them and grows stronger every day. Hundreds of farm workers have joined the 350-mile trek from Delano to Sacramento in an attempt to recruit new members for the oldest farm workers union in the country. UFW co-founder Dolores Huerta participated in the original march with Chavez and is making the pilgrimage again.
So at this point, we've traveled over
about 180 miles, so we're like over the halfway point on the way to Sacramento. And it's been a very, very exciting time. Every evening we have these rallies where we have had up to almost 1,000 people every single night, and in some places 2,000 people. And we have had to date over 11,000 people who've joined the march as we've gone along. And, you know, we've had a lot of people signing the authorization cards. We now have close to 6,000 authorization cards that people have signed for the union to represent them. So it's been very, very exciting.
So at least 6,000 new members at this point.
Yes,
Mm-hmm. Now, you bring a special perspective to this march in that you participated in the original march with Cesar Chavez. Any moments of deja vu for you?
Well, yes, in some ways, it's good to see some of the, you know, people who were there at the very beginning and who, many of them who became active in the union after that first pilgrimage that was done back in 1966. And, of course, then going through some of the same fields that we went through before, and then, of course, seeing that some of the conditions of the workers have deteriorated so that they're almost back to the place that they were back then in 1966. And, of course, that's very sad, and it makes us feel kind of bad to know that there are workers that are now suffering some of those same conditions, even though there have been a lot of improvements made over the years. The basic fact that they are still earning very low wages, of course, makes us feel